Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 37 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. While it can be easy to forget sometimes in a cloud of dates and statistics and shelf marks, history is made up of people. Ordinary and extraordinary people who have left interesting and tantalizing pieces of their stories behind. It's the story of how they navigated their own worlds, and sometimes found themselves having to navigate unfamiliar ones by reinventing themselves and forging new paths. When it comes to stories of reinvention and forging new paths, there's one historian whose body of work stands out. I'm talking, of course, about the amazing Dr. Natalie Zeman Davis. Natalie's work includes the famous Return of Martin Guerre, Women on the Margins, 3 17th Century Lives, and Trickster Travels, among numerous other books and articles. She's taught at Princeton and at the University of Toronto, and she's both a Companion of the Order of Canada and the winner of the American National Humanities Medal, which she received from President Barack Obama in 2013. Throughout her career, she's been hugely influential in the way she tells stories, as well as ensuring that a wide range of voices are heard. I sat down with the lovely and legendary Natalie Zeman Davis at her home in Toronto, where she kindly made me a cup of tea and talked to me about her work and our field. We talked about Martin Guerre, her work on Leo Africanus and the new play based on it, and what the historian's role is when it comes to bringing people together and changing the world. On the eve of her 91st birthday next month, here's what she had to say. So thank you, Natalie, for talking to me today. It's such a pleasure to meet you for the first time. I went and heard you speak about a decade ago when Trickster Travels came out, and I'd like to talk about that in a little bit, but it's great to meet you. So happy to have you here.
Glad to be here, Danielle. Very glad.
So let's talk about what was probably your first breakout book, and that was The Return of Martin Guerre. And I actually hadn't read it before. Peter loaned it to me last week, and I read it, and it's fascinating. So can you tell people a little bit about that story that got you really kind of well-known on the world stage?
The story follows the adventures of a wife, Bertrande, in the mountains of the Pyrenees, from a peasant family, whose village husband, Martin Guerre, abandoned her. And then after 3 or 4 years, by the way, we're in the 16th century with all this story, 3 or 4 years, he comes back, or at least he seems to come back. She welcomes him, lives with him what appears to be a very happy marriage, has a child. She'd already had a child by him before he left, has another child. And then after 3 years together, she accuses him of not being Martin Guerre, but an imposter. I heard about this story in a book written by the judge who tried the case against the alleged Martin Guerre in 1560. And after the trial, when the alleged Martin Guerre was in fact found to be an imposter, the judge said, having condemned him to death, he said not merely to be hanged, but to be burned, so his memory will be effaced forever. That judge sat down and wrote a book about it, calling it The Memorable Decree. And I read that book many years ago. It was in the late 1980s. And I read the judge's book, and I thought, this has got to be a movie. This is such a marvelous story. Why was it a marvelous story? First of all, it was about peasants. And so often, it's hard to find a living story about these people who were illiterate, who lived, you know, hundreds of years ago. You could get tax records, you could get real estate records. But here I could tell a story. I could bring some people to life. And it was a story that could reach people. It didn't just have to go to people in academe. So as I say, my first notion was it would have to be a film. And by good luck, I met some French filmmakers who simultaneously had wanted to make a movie about it. So we teamed up for a film. But I also felt, especially as I worked on the film, it's a good film. It's very good, with Gérard Depardieu playing Martin Guerre, or playing the imposter for Martin Guerre, and other very, very good people playing Natalie Bai, playing Bertrand and so forth. I thought this is a wonderful, wonderful possibility. But I did feel that it needed to be a book as well. It needed to have more archival depth to it and more nuance than we could get, more complexity, it turns out, we could get in the film. So that was how this book came about. and I had hoped to make it of interest both to scholars, because it was bringing something new about peasant life, about peasant family life, about the potentiality of peasant men and women to shape their lives, even though ultimately the real Martin Guerre came back and the false Martin Guerre was in fact hanged and burned. It showed those that a kind of dimension to peasant life that was often left out of most of the more economically based or stories about peasant taxation. And I liked that feature, and I liked the fact that it could go both to scholars and to a large public, and it did.
Yeah, I love that story because it's, like you say, it's not only a good story, but it gives you a vehicle to talk about what life was like in southern France at that time, and also the motivations behind all the thinking that people were going through when they were deciding whether to support this imposter or not. Because I think if you look at this story kind of from the outside, it would be easy for people to say, oh, these people, they couldn't even tell the difference between one man and another. And you really get at politically why you might choose to support the imposter or not. And some of it was even based on the religious tensions at that time, wasn't it?
Absolutely. This is set, the story, during the wars of religion, during the growth of Protestantism and then the outbreaks. And though the evidence wasn't completely clear in the court case and all the documents that I had about this particular family, the Guerre family, and the Rolls family, who were the main families, I knew that the village at which this had all happened, Artigat is the name of the Pyrenean village, was split between Protestants and Catholics. And the judge in the case, the man that wrote the story, was a famous Protestant, always very fair in his judgments. He was very fair, but he was a famous Protestant who ultimately lost his life in the massacres of Protestants later on in the 1560s. So that played in the story. I had to figure out how shaping a religious life in a new religion felt connected with peasants deciding to reshape their lives. And it seemed to me that the coincidence of Protestantism and the choices offered by Protestantism was one of the things that led this couple to decide to take on new identity, that he would take on a new identity. I called it shaping a marriage or inventing a marriage. And at a time when people were trying to reshape their religious loyalties and rethink some of their religious commitments, I thought there was a kind of convergence there. That part of the book is speculative. Much that I say about the evidence in regard to who the imposter was, the imposter being welcomed into the family, the turning of the family against him, that was based on firm evidence, and I searched the archives for it. What I've just said to you about religion, that the fact that there was religious conflict, that's established too. The speculation about the way in which religion figured in the sensibilities of Bertrand and the false Martin, Arno is his real name, that was speculative. But I felt it was important, while identifying for my readers that it was speculative, that I couldn't prove that they had been Protestants for a time, that it was important to bring it in. I think historians must be aware of the broad cultural, political, and religious environments in which they work. And just because you're dealing with illiterate peasants doesn't let you off the hook there. In fact, it's exciting to do the speculation, try to bring in these variables, as long as you're very clear to your readers that this is speculative. You use words like perhaps or maybe, and they know that you are that's less substantial in its support than some of the other things you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because, like I say, you're able to get at kind of that human story behind it, and it's nothing that you can actually prove because you can't get at people's true thoughts most of the time. I mean, this judge laid out a lot of his thoughts for us very clearly in the book, which you go over in a way that I think really works. But many times it seems that your work is based on individuals and you kind of build your historical case around individuals, even though a lot of that sometimes has to be speculative. What is it that speaks to you about individual stories when you're looking at the past?
I care about individuals, especially because it allows you to see through individual lives how general trends are experienced, how they play out and impact the decisions people make at different stages of their lives, opportunities they give people. the obstacles that they place into people's lives. I haven't only worked on individuals. A few of my studies, a few of my books, have taken more general themes. I've worked very early along on forms of working class resistance, early trade unions, for instance, forms of poor relief. In a more recent times, I did a whole book just on the gift in 16th century France and the different ways in which people made presents to each other, bribed each other. But it is true that even when I did that, took general themes, I always tried to illustrate what I was doing along the way with stories of individual cases. I felt it came to life that way. The advantage, however, of sometimes just focusing on a family, the Martin Guerre family, or some of the others that I have looked at, some of the women that I have looked at, was precisely what I just sort of say, repeat what I said before, that you could get at the way that life was felt. When I did the study of three women, a Protestant, Catholic, and a Jewish woman a little bit, after the medieval period, it was a way to get at the exact challenges and experience of motherhood, not just through looking at records of life and death of mothers in their childbirth. We can get that fascinating and important information, not just by looking at the works of midwives, and we have some right at the end of the Middle Ages that tell us, okay, we have some medieval midwives accounts, which tell us how women survived bringing children into the world. But if you get an individual life story, you can get the woman's feelings about it, expressed through diaries that they may have left or conversations that they've had. I really think that adds a great deal, and that kind of thing has turned me toward individual stories.
I think that's fair, because a lot of the times when people are writing in the Middle Ages, they're not writing at a distance. They're writing about they're writing about themselves, and they're writing their personal stories. So I think to look at the personal stories and take them not exactly at face value, because you're doing your background research as well, but to take them as an individual wanting to tell their story, I think that is a very good way of doing history. And you were kind of at the beginning of that wasn't really super accepted when you started to write this stuff, was it?
When I turned to the Martin Guerre story, I would say it was a little bit of a challenge for the kind of academic historian that I was. My friend Carlo Ginzburg was just then doing his Minocchio, his Miller. It was coincidental. We both went on the same path separately and coincidentally, but I think with the same concerns in mind. And with Martin Guerre and Bertrand, it was exceptional. That is, to get at an individual family the way I could do later with women who'd left diaries. They were modest women. They were from artisanal families and merchant families, but they were literate. And to be able to do that with a peasant family really requires luck. That is, to find a court case in which they are constantly being interviewed and people in villages are being interviewed, so you can get these different voices. And to be able to do with that level of society, with the illiterate level of society, is a gift from the past.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to come back to women's history for a minute, because you are always a champion of women's history, creating courses, some early courses in women's history specifically, which wasn't being done a lot. In the 70s, I think you created one for U of T. What do you think about women's history now, and how it's evolved from when you were creating these courses, and what it's like now? And if you think it's still worth doing as kind of a distinct field of women's history, what do you think about women's history right now?
There's a lot of very exciting work still being done. And I just was reading about Sharon Strokia's book on women healers in the late medieval period in Italy. Well, actually very late. It's really late on into the Renaissance in Italy. All, you know, new finds right and left. And I think there's still a role to concentrate on just finding things about women. Of course, it always must be done with a wider view of the field. That is, you don't just do women healers, for instance. You look at what's happening in medicine more generally to see what's distinctive, if anything, about the women's practice. So I think there's a lot of research left to be done. I think we are now at the stage where much of gender history, let's use the wider term because it involves men as well as women, should be incorporated, and I think it is often now, into courses, to more general courses. It should be now making a difference along with other variables in whatever we teach. Is there still a role for some separate courses? Yes, I think some, just as there's still a role for courses on peasant studies, even though we want rural studies to be part of the general history program, just as there's a role for the theme, let's say, of immigration, foreigners in European medieval cities or early modern cities, we can still, a lot of special research can be done and there could be special seminars on that. Increasingly, this should be integrated into general courses, and I'm not sure that it always is. I think there may be a gender week here and there. I think there's a lot to be done. I also am not sure whether the very exciting programs that continue, especially in women's and gender history, are getting the crossover that I hope they are. I hope they will. There still may be a little bit too much separation going on. I don't know that it will last, but I think the hopeful thing is that good research is being done, both on the in the field of integration and in the field of separate studies. So that's the hopeful thing.
Do you mean that you're not seeing a lot of crossover kind of between disciplines in this type of thing?
Gender in women's history to begin with was an interdisciplinary field, always requiring the expertise of one's own craft, to be sure. So that was the case, that is the case, I think, in gender writing. The conferences on women's history and gender history do tend to be interdisciplinary. And I think in a field like medieval studies, they are particularly successfully so. What I'm concerned about is, and it may maybe I'm wrong, I don't need to be concerned, whether that's happening on the level of teaching and courses as opposed to scholarly communication, whether the field has changed so that it's a complete integration, or whether it's still the case that instead of integration you have your woman's history week in the course, and then you do it that way, rather than simply being integrated as relevant throughout the whole year.
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, I would agree with you on that as well. I think sometimes it is too distinct, and then it separates itself from being, you know, half of human history, and it really should be integrated in a way that you're saying. So as somebody who came up as a woman in a man's field, how do you think that the field has changed for women as scholars?
Well, there are many, many women working in history right now. I mean, I'm retired, so I'm not seeing it in the thick of the battle, but it seems to me that the field has been transformed. That the field of history is really made of women and men, both. I hope that we don't face a situation where people are going to talk about the field being feminized and men aren't welcome in it. I think this is a field that we should be working in together.
I think that as scholars, we're starting to work together in a way that's making it just more fruitful for everybody. And I'm glad that you're seeing that as well. So let's talk about what you've been working on kind of more recently. You've been working for a long time now on Leo Africanus, right? And he's somebody that you love, and I really want to talk about him. So who was Leo Africanus?
Leo Africanus's real name was Hassan Al-Wazan, a North African Muslim, actually born in Granada before that area of Spain had fallen to the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, but had moved very early in his life, taken by his parents to North Africa, to Fez, grew up there, trained as a learned jurist, a faqih, and soon became a diplomat for the Sultan of Fez. Traveled in that capacity down to the land of the blacks, it was called, down to Mali and that region, Gao, crossed over the desert to Egypt, always in a caravan with merchants and others in his diplomatic entourage, went up all the way to Istanbul and so forth. We're now in the early years of the 16th century, and then in 1518 was captured by Christian pirates on the Mediterranean. There were both Christian and Muslim pirates in the Mediterranean. He happened to fall in the hands of the Christians. He was taken to Rome, and as an important diplomat, one indeed who had just come from Selim's Istanbul, was taken to Pope Leo X, who for a time imprisoned him in the Vatican until he converted to Christianity, or at least seeming to convert it, talked with him often until Leo X died, and then he stayed on, Leo did, well, as I should say, converted to Christianity and given the name, I'm skipping his, converted to Christianity with godparents from the cardinalship important cardinals, and was given the name Giovanni Leone, Johannes Leo, of the African. So that's where the Leo Africanus is sort of the short version that has been given him over the years. But also given him because before he left, and he did return to North Africa and presumably to Islam in 1527, after 9 years in Italy, he returned and returned to Islam. But before he returned, he wrote books in Italian and in Latin, learning the languages of the country where he was a captive for a time, about the world he left behind. A very important book called The Description of Africa, and some other books about the Prophet, about Islam, about Arabic poetry, several about great Arabic learned men. But the most important was The Description of Africa. He called it the cosmographical and geographical description of Africa. And he described all the countries that he'd visited and their culture and their economy, occasionally very good anecdotes. The book was left in manuscript when he returned, and a humanist editor, a man named Ramuzio, with this manuscript, edited it and brought it out as a printed book in Venice around 1550. The real edition was 1556. There may have been an earlier edition, but at any rate, he brought it out and it became a bestseller. First, it was in Italian, and then it was translated into Latin and into French, and ultimately, by the end of the century, into English. It became a bestseller in his absence. So I was extraordinarily interested in this man. This man, I called him a trickster. Explained why I called him a trickster, but I saw him as between worlds, that is holding on to his Muslim identity at the same time that he became perforce a Christian, but was really interested in the Christian world in which he lived. He learned its languages. He had important friendships especially among learned Jews who were sort of in the same somewhat marginal position that he was. He was in contact with his cardinal. His main godfather was Cardinal Egidio de Viterbo, who was an extremely important figure in humanist studies among the Catholics of the early 16th century, and deeply interested also in converting all the Muslims in the world to Christianity. He was sort of hoping that his godson, this Leo Africanus, would teach him enough about Islam so that he could be a successful missionary, which he wasn't, but he had this hope. So this interesting connection, when I say between worlds, that he both kept his loyalty to Islam, he wrote about Islam, and wrote about it for Europeans with extreme balance. If you look at most of the writings of the late medieval and early years of the 16th century, you find vitriol, virulence. Even when it's done with a very scholarly way, it's always done with a polemic frame. And he wrote about Islam and Christianity as it came into his story with balance. The text is fascinating, but it's not full of taking sides or excitement. It's quite remarkable in its tone. Well, I thought that was fascinating. And I wanted to write about this man between worlds. I called him a trickster, which is, you may think of as a more Italian, late medieval Italian or early Renaissance Italian term. But I wouldn't have called him that if there had not been an Islamic literary genre, beloved of readers of Arabic, called the Makamah, which follows a trickster disguised poet through many, many stories, he's always narrating, but he's always being narrated about. And each story is called a makamah. And I love those figures, and I thought they are trickster figures. And there's even an Arabic word that sort of approximates that concept, a kind of fool figure. So I wanted, maybe I pushed it too far, but I wanted to see him not only as between worlds, but as performing. The notion of performance was very key, as he both was a Muslim, but he was performing, happily performing in a way, even though he was forced to convert to begin with. He was interested in performing as a Christian. And I liked that. I wanted to introduce that notion of performance into my Between Worlds book. So that's why I called it that, and I love working on him.
Yeah, that was Trickster Travels. And like I said, that was the first time I heard you speak. And the second time I heard you speak in person was probably 2 years ago, maybe last year at Kalamazoo, talking about conversos. You were moderating a discussion about conversos. So obviously this is something that is very interesting to you. Keep working on it. And we just have seen Trickster Travels has been translated into Chinese. So congratulations. People all over the world are reading that. And that came out in 2006, I think, right? And you're still working on Leo. What are you doing with Leo now?
Well, right now I'm taking a look at something I didn't consider in the book, his interest in theater. And this came about when, not a couple of years after the book came out, Stratford, Ontario Shakespeare Festival wanted to commission a play connected with Trickster Travels. And I was quite thrilled about it because I thought, well, that will be different from Othello. My Moor is not at all like Othello. Not that Shakespeare's book play isn't something to admire, but mine is just a totally different kind of man, learned diplomat, and not torn in a marriage and so forth. Different story. So,
an interesting kind of contemporary as well, because it's in the 1550s. I mean, 1590s that Shakespeare is writing as well. So it's kind of interesting that it's contemporary too.
And between worlds, yes. At a time, writing my book meant a great deal to me in the wake of 9/11, and to be able to do a play on that just seemed to me a wonderful opportunity. So the person that I particularly was enthusiastic about that Stratford loved was Wajdi Mouawad, the Lebanese French Quebecois playwright whose play Scorched has been incendie in French, has been a big success not only in Europe but in both the United States and in Canada. People who have seen it, has been made into a film. And that play, which is about the war in Lebanon, though that is never named, but it's clear that that's it, had the same concerns about violence and alternatives to violence that had motivated in part my scholarly enterprise with Al-Wazan, with Leo Africanus. And I was sure that Wajdi would want to pick this up, and he did. But he went, and I'll just be very brief here, he said, you know, you've already written the book, the history book. So instead, he wanted to take certain themes from my life, Between Worlds, because I have some things that fit with that, in his own life as an Arab Between Worlds, Arabic, French, Canadian, and so forth, and wove the story of Leo Africanus into a play about a star-crossed marriage between an Arab-American graduate student, a beautiful woman at Columbia University, who's doing her doctoral dissertation on Al-Wazan, rather than having an old Jewish lady writing a book. And she falls in love with another graduate student at Columbia who is an Israeli from a German-Israeli family doing genetics. So he does a play about the conflict that's generated by that marriage, especially in his family. And Al-Wazan appears in the play along the way, talking with her. I mean, the parts when he talks with her are taken. She says the things that I say in my book, but that's fine. And his Between Worlds story fits as a kind of philosophical reaction to the conflict between the parents, who are not too happy about Between Worlds. Well, having worked with Wajdi, followed this play along over the time, I thought, why didn't I work on theater in my book? I had talked a lot about poetry, and I contrasted, to some extent, Arabic poetry with the poetry that Wazan would have met, Leo Africanus would have met, as he learned Italian during his years in Italy. And so I decided, in connection with working with Wajdi, to do something using a Leo Africanus sort of as my spectator, as my eye, so to speak, contrasting late medieval Arabic theater, which has been very little studied. There's a few books on it, and it's now, even since I began my own project, more people are working on it, and comparing that with what he would have seen when he got to Rome. And I was in luck there. In fact, this is partly why I did the project, because if Arabic theater was still continuing its sort of popular street version, it was kind of a popular street version of popular street theater, street actors and jugglers. It was a lively theater on peasant themes and on crossed marriage themes and themes where judges are made fun of and have to judge cases. Well, that was going on. but still a kind of a street theater rather than a theater moving into buildings with sultans as important patrons. There was a little bit of that, but you don't have much. In contrast, this is the period when late medieval theater turns into what we call the early Renaissance theater, and you have the great, not only some tragedies, but you have the great comedies, some of them influenced by reading antique comedies. Those antique comedies were known by the learned men in North Africa and in Istanbul, in the world of North African scholarship as well. But theater was not so much a serious subject for the learned men, the learned faqih, like Al was on. They thought, this is fine, but it's something for the inns, for the taverns, something that we can wash with the prostitutes or something, which was the case with the great medieval Arabic puppet theater of Ibn Danial. There was an interesting theater, but it was, if learned men looked into it, it was thought of as sort of slumming, having fun. Whereas in early 16th century, there's a kind of interesting contrast with these learned men of North Africa and Istanbul in Italy. Some of them, like the great Machiavelli, begin to think, well, we can write for the stage too. So that is happening in the early 1520s. And I can document my man at a performance of Machiavelli's Mandragola. I can document it in 1520, and I now see that he wrote about it in a very witty way in that book about description of Africa that I mentioned. Having got that information in my mind, I decided to write this little book, which it's just a short book, but which makes a contrast between two worlds of theater, tries to account for some of the differences in the direction that they went, but can end with this lovely story of Leo Africanus watching Mandragola by Machiavelli.
I love that. And I really like how you're making this connection kind of in an opposite direction, because in when people study theater, there's often that influence of Italian theater on Western theater, but you don't usually have that connection between, like you say, Italian theater and Arabic theater. And I think that's brilliant. It must have been so much fun to work on.
Oh, it was. I haven't found any direct influence at that date of the Arabic theater on the Italian. I just use him as somebody who knows both as a way to tell a story. I have not found any examples of communication. It would be, maybe somebody else will. Maybe if when I publish this, somebody else will be able to find it.
That's the next project. I wanted to talk a little bit about your between worlds as well. Your history has been between worlds, and we don't have to get into too much specific detail, but one of the reasons you came to Canada was because of some political unrest. So what do you think that the role of a historian is in bridging these gaps between cultures, between worlds? What do you think the role of the historian is in that kind of bringing people together?
I think we have a role to play, I'd say, cooperatively with historians from other cultures. It should be a two-way project. I think we, first of all, we tell our own stories, we tell each other's stories. I think it's important to share stories. That is to say, and I'm thinking, of course, in a way of the conflict about Indigenous history right now, so deeply important. Who can write it in Canada? And Indigenous people have absolutely the right to tell their own story. It's critically important. And the classrooms, the documents, the resources, the archives must be made available for them to do it. And we listen to it. But I think no one has a monopoly, complete monopoly on their own story. It's important that others simultaneously make those studies and try to learn from them and to share stories. And I feel that across the board, that North African, the study of the Arab world, of the Islamic world, must be taken up by people from outside. We must do the serious scholarship necessarily and research necessarily to be credible, and we contribute to it. They learn from us, we learn from them. So I think see it as absolutely dialogic, and it's something that teaches about each other and helps us work together, and certainly broadens our political and mental horizons at the current time. How much difference we historians can make in our communications with each other, I don't know. I think we have to work on many fronts on that regard. But again, thinking of Islam, Christianity, Judaism right now, the more we can understand each other's histories in that regard, the better we are to bring those perspectives to bear on diplomacy and to try to have some kind of impact that leads to go back to my Leo Africanus, deciding that it's better to talk with each other, even debate with each other, than to kill each other.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. It's been wonderful for me, and really good luck with the next book that's coming out shortly. You're finishing that up now, right?
I hope so. I'm calling it Leo Africanus Discovers Comedy, and I'm hoping to finish it before I turn 91.
Yes, that's a good goal. Who's publishing that one?
I haven't yet decided yet. I'm going to just work on that after I finish.
Okay, we will definitely keep an eye out for it. So thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Danielle. And I'm hoping to get thoughts from your listeners that could help me improve my work.
Absolutely. We'll give out the call. Thank you. You can find out more about Natalie's work by visiting the University of Toronto's academia.edu page at utoronto.academia.edu/Natalie Zeman Davis. The play, based on her book Trickster Travels, is called Birds of a Kind. And if you want to reach out to Natalie, like she said, drop me a line at danielle@medievalist.net and I'll pass your email along. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Well, we still have some glitches with the website. If you're looking on mobile, where some pages come up gibberish, but we're working through that. Meanwhile, we are all getting ready for Halloween here on medievalist.net with lots of camp posts about all things horror, all things ghosty, things like that. So you can read a bit about werewolves. You can read about horror in the Canterbury Tales. And if you're looking for something a little more mundane, we have a news piece about a 10 million euro project to discuss migrations in the early Middle Ages. So all that and more this week on medievalist.net.
Sounds awesome. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
As Peter said, he's working on getting the mobile version of medievalist.net fixed. But in the meantime, this might be the perfect opportunity to check out our Patreon page, where you can get the desktop version of medievalist.net ad-free for just $3 per month. And you can find more information about our monthly book club with Boyd Allen Brewer. That's patreon.com/medievalists. And speaking of books, my new book, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, got restocked again by Amazon UK, although they are running low again, which I'm so happy to see. If you're interested, you can pick up a copy there or through Pen and Sword History at pen-and-sword.co.uk. Thank you to you amazing people of the UK for supporting my work. I hope that you love the book. If you're not in the UK, don't worry, it's coming to you over the next couple months. To keep up with all the latest in the medieval world, you can follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. And you can find me on social media too. You can look up my name, Danielle Sibalski, but if that's a challenge to spell, and believe me, it is, just look for me under at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thank you, as always, for lending me your ears this week. Have yourself a wonderful day.